Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
In this truth, in this faith we trust, for while we have our eyes on the future, history has its eyes on us. This is the era of just redemption.
For many months, we have grieved by ourselves. Tonight, we grieve and begin healing together.
It's hard not to get choked up watching it. It's just so incredible. And I'm optimistic.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
I think America is relieved. Beating the final boss took a little longer than we'd hoped, but Donald Trump is gone.
It's going to get better, but it's not going to happen overnight.
If my name ever goes down into history, it'll be for this act. And my whole soul is in it. My whole soul is in it.
I'm Kai Wright. Welcome to the show. And we're going to dedicate this show to making a transition together. Because we did initially create the United States of Anxiety in response to the 2016 presidential elections. That's the name. Plainly, Donald Trump has taken up so much space emotionally, mentally, politically. And in the wake of all that, I'm asking myself, what have I been carrying around for the past 5 years that I can put down? And conversely, what do I need to hold on to? So for instance, even Twitter, it really wasn't a thing in my life 4 years ago, but now I tend to start my days in my Twitter feed, chasing the invariably bad news of the day, which I know is a really awful idea for a host of reasons, but there it is, I do it. And to manage that, I've also sort of packed my timeline with counter-programming. So one thing that happens routinely is a little snippet of a poem will pop up in my feed because someone will say, hey, stop this and go read a poem. Quite often, it's a Jericho Brown poem. And when I take the advice and step away from my computer and open one of his books, my whole body shifts to a healthier place. Jericho Brown won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 2020 for his book, The Tradition, which is his third collection. And since his poetry has held my hand many a morning, I asked him to help convene the show today. So, Jericho, thank you so much for accepting that invitation.
Thank you so much, Kai, for saying that. I am stunned. I'm sitting here with my mouth open. It's so kind. Thank you.
You're a humble man. Thank you. So we've all been reminded of the power of words, certainly, over the past 4 years. Donald Trump used language and these just word storms as his primary political weapons. And Joe Biden is now sort of explicitly trying to contrast himself through his own language and how he's used words. And I wonder if you can just reflect on language over the past 4 years, just the words we've taken in and how they've affected us. As a person who specializes in the carefully chosen word, I wonder what that's been like for you.
I think what's been most interesting to me is that we've probably gained a better idea that the word does indeed have power in and of itself, that when you say a thing, when you write a thing down, you are more likely in a position to make that thing true. And I think maybe before Donald Trump, people were a little bit glib about that, that knowledge, you know. But no matter how much he might have later had to say that he was only joking, most of us knew when Donald Trump said something, he was going to do it. And that culminated in that horrendous Wednesday event, the insurrection. So when I think about the power of the word, I think about the uses of imagination. I hope that what we have learned is that we have just as much power over that as Donald Trump. You know, mm-hmm. that I have a way of building for myself the world I want to see. If you want to see a world of strife, then your words can make that happen. So that the opposite must be possible. And that's what I try to do with my poems.
That's a lovely sentiment. What about the question I sort of put to myself here at the beginning? For you, is there anything you've been carrying around that you feel like you can put down now?
That's a great question. I do feel lighter. So I must have.
There's some baggage left.
I will tell you this, and I think... I think it becomes easier to look at one's self or to look at one's close community when you're not busy facing some supposed enemy, right? It's hard to take care of yourself. You know, I want to live in a world where I thrive as opposed to living in a world where I feel like I survive. Those are two different ways of being. And I'm really interested in thriving. And because I'm interested in thriving, I'm in a position where I want, I'd rather not have to deal with the guy who used to be in the White House. You know, it just feels better. So
right. That's a really interesting idea, right? Like that if you, you know, when you can actually stop and think about yourself, actually stop and think about where you want to go if you're not so busy thinking about where you don't want to go.
Yeah, there's also real fear. If you have this sense that someone unstable is running the show, but they have things like nuclear codes, that's real fear that I think even if we don't voice, we sort of wake up and go to bed with every night. And I think that's, I mean, when you think that's dangerous, you know, and that's the stress many of us have literally been carrying around.
Yeah. What about the inverse? Is there something you've picked up, positive or negative, over these recent years that you want to hold on to as you move forward?
I just think that I've learned a lot more that there really needs to be more platforms available for that which is the supposed radical left in this nation. It's so interesting to hear people call people like Reverend Warnock, my senator from Georgia, call people like that a radical. I'm thinking, that's a radical? Wow. So,
what does that make me?
Exactly. So if it seems to me that we have a better middle, you know, right now I have a fear of what people in this nation call moderate. I don't think of that as the real middle. And I know that in order to make something closer to a real middle happen, we need to have some people pushing a little bit farther left. And I feel like that's what I'm here for.
What do you think of this idea? I know you said you were flattered by it, but this idea that your poetry for a lot of people has been kind of counter-programming over this time. Because I, you know, when I see it, it's someone else has tweeted it, has said, hey, you know what? You should go read this Jericho Brown poem. What do you think about that? The idea of poetry as counter-programming to the news, I guess.
It's wonderful because, as I said before, I believe in that. I believe that poetry stops time. That poetry puts us in a position where we have no choice but to slow down. That poetry allows us to, you're literally looking at ink on paper and suddenly you have images in your mind. And so poetry gives us an opportunity to breathe a little more deeply, to save ourselves a little bit more through the day. So I believe in that sentiment. And I am, because I believe in it, I'm particularly grateful when somebody says it about me, since it's all I ever wanted to do since I was 10 years old. So it means the world to me.
Well, so you wrote a poem to mark the inauguration. It was published in the New York Times Online on Inauguration Day.
Yeah.
And the other reason that I asked you here today is I'm hoping that you'll read that for us to start today's show.
Yeah, I'll read it. I'll read it. Here we go. Inaugural. We were told that it is dangerous to touch, and yet we journeyed here, where what we believe meets what must be done. You want to see, in spite of my mask, my face. We imagine, in time of disease, our grandmothers whole. We imagine an impossible America and call one another a fool for doing so. Grown up from the ground, thrown out of the sea, fallen from the sky. No matter how we've come a mighty long way. If I touch any of you, if I shake one hand, I am nearer another beginning. Can't you feel it? The trouble with me is I'm just like you. I don't want to be hopeful if it means I've got to be naive. I've bent so low in my hunger, my hair's already been in the soup. And when I speak, it's just beneath my self-imposed halo. You'll forgive me if you can forgive yourself. I forgive you as you build a museum of weapons we soon visit just to see what we once were. I forgive us our debts. We were told to wake up grateful, so we try to fall asleep that way. Where then shall we put our pains when we want rest? I don't carry a knife, but I understand the desperation of those who do, which is why I am recounting the facts as calmly as I can. The year is new, and we mean to use our imaginations. One of us wants to raise George Stinney from the dead. One of us wants a small vial of the sweat left on Sylvia Rivera's headband. Some want to be the music made magical by Bill Withers' stutter. Others come with maps and magnifying glasses and graphite pencils to find locations beside the mind where we are not patrolled or surveilled or corralled or chained. I myself have come to reclaim the teeth in George Washington's mouth and plant them in the backyards of big houses that are not in my name. My cousins want to share a single bale of the cotton our mothers picked as children. I would love to live in a country that lets me grow old. I long for that. We are otherwise easily satisfied. Where do we get tangerines for cheap? Can we make it there on the metro? How hot is the fire fairy blister of chocolate chipotle sauce? And will you judge me if I taste it? But now we've put our hunger down for the time it takes to come and reconcile ourselves to the land because it is holy, to the water, because it swallowed our ancestors, to the air, because we are dumb enough to decide on something as difficult as love. If no one's punishment leads to my salvation, then accountability is what waits. It moves citizens, men's nations. That's for us to prove. That's the deed to witness. That's the single item on the agenda, read in Braille or by eye, ink drying like blood spilled this American hour of our lives.
Jericho Brown's poem Inaugural was published in the New York Times Magazine. His collection, The Tradition, won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. Jericho, thank you so much for helping us inaugurate a new chapter of this show.
Thank you, Kai.
We began with a poet, and now we turn to a historian to think about sitting in the aftermath of great crimes. I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety. We'll be right back. Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know, like there are urgent things happening in the world, but all you hear is noise. That's where What Next comes in, a daily news show we love from Slate. They tell you the stories you haven't heard before or a different side to the stories you thought you already knew. Join host Mary Harris every day as she cuts through the noise so that together we can all figure out what next. Follow and listen wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. Like so many of you out there, this week I'm just trying to exhale, to let out some of the anxiety and the fear and the rage that I have held so tightly over the recent years, over certainly the past year. But I'm also thinking about what I cannot forget, what I have to hold on to, even as the national conversation turns to renewal. So I'm joined now by a historian who's made it her life's work to research the aftermath of anti-Black violence. Kanata Williams is a professor of African American history at Wayne State University. She's the author of the book, They Left Great Marks on Me, African American Testimonies of Racial Violence from Emancipation to World War I. And she was one of the co-creators of a remarkable public history project that you may remember. It was called the Charleston Syllabus, and it was sort of a resource list for public learning after the murders at Mother Emanuel Amian Church in Charleston in 2015. Dr. Williams, first off, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I want to start, I mentioned that Charleston Syllabus project because I do want to start there. It grew into a book that you also co-edited. And Joe Biden, he says he decided to run for president again at this late stage in his career because he saw what happened at the white nationalist rally in Charlottesville 2 years after the murders in Charleston. And to a lot of people, that event and the insurrection on January 6th of this year, they're just points in a timeline with Charleston. But your work with that syllabus, you're saying that all of these events are part of a much longer timeline of violence. And so I wonder what you would say to President Biden, who, again, was motivated to office, to his whole office, by this violence in Charlottesville. I wonder what you would say to him he should know if repairing that is what he wants to do.
I think that what I would say to the president is that he needs to make sure that he understands that we have a long history of this violence dating back to slavery, coming forward with Klan strikes and massacres and rampages during Reconstruction, lynching and assassinations during Jim Crow. And that this violence has left a significant impact on African Americans and the rest of the nation. And part of what happens is that we go through this cycle. There's the violence, there's the impunity, the law is often used as a shield against truth and justice. There are calls to quickly move forward and on healing without any real acknowledgement of the real harm that's done and no policy to stop it from happening again. And then there's the erasure of what happened as the nation moves on. And because the Americans have preferred the easy way out, the cycle repeats and Black and brown people continue to suffer and die. So what I would say to the president is that if he knows this history and he's determined to stop the cycle, then we need to have a real accounting for what has happened, and we need real policy measures in order to stop it from happening again.
Yeah. So I don't know if you were able to hear my conversation with Jericho Brown before the break, but he read this his poem that he wrote for the inauguration, and there's a line in it, he says, "Where then shall we put our pains when we want rest?" And I that line really hits me. And I'm thinking about it in relationship to your work because your book looks at these personal testimonies of people touched by anti-Black violence in the run-up to the Civil Rights Movement. And I wonder if there's a particular story in that history that you'd want to share with us with that line in mind.
So I think I'll share the story of Gaynor Atkins. His son, Charlie Atkins, was killed by a mob in Georgia in 1922. And he and his wife are brutalized and arrested shortly afterwards. And I discover him in the historical record 5 years later when Gaynor, the father, starts writing letters to the NAACP. And he's trying to get something close to justice because he can't get his son back. But losing his son the way he did is weighing heavily on his heart. And that's one of the realities that we see with African Americans, especially if we look at the pain of the violence that's done to them. Often what happens is that we focus on the fact that violence happened and we think about it in the abstract, and we don't make time for or sit with what African Americans say this violence has done to them. And Gaynor's letters to the NAACP make that clear, that he is aching, that he is anguished by losing his 13-year-old son in this way. And he says in his letter to Walter White that he wants someone to help lift that burden. Mm. And he doesn't quite know for sure what that actually looks like, what will lift that burden, but he believes that something needs to be done, preferably to stop this violence from happening. And so that line in the poem acknowledges the harms of whiteness and the commitment to white supremacy and the fact that Black people often don't have the opportunity to deal with the reality of what has happened to them and to have it acknowledged by the larger society.
I wonder about you doing this work. I mean, the big question I'm asking throughout this show is I'm thinking for myself about what I want to put down. I want to put that down. I want to put that kind of pain down. I'll be honest. You know, that's something I just don't want to stare at anymore. And you have made it your work to call us into staring into it. And so I guess for you personally, why do you feel called to that work?
I feel called to the work because I think that too many people take the easy way out and run from the violence. So you and I right now are not experiencing this violence. We haven't had our lives personally turned upside down and inside out by it. And so if we really believe in justice, then we have a responsibility to sit with, to know what happened, so we can play a role in stopping it from happening to other people. And that's why for me, I think it's important to understand, to listen to survivors, to not discredit them, to not deny them authority over their own stories about what happened to them and what was still happening to them. And to that point, I think we have a lot to learn from them. What survivors tell us is that racist violence, it doesn't have a sort of a neat beginning, middle, and end. It doesn't end when the person who's committing the violence goes away or stops. It reverberates throughout their lives. And what you often see is that survivors often talk in the active present tense. We use the past tense. We've got the luxury of doing that. But people who are still living with the fallout of the violence talk about it in ways that it's ongoing. And so again, I think that because I believe in justice, I want to play a role in helping people know and understand what the violence does to people and how that injustice gnaws away at them and how it corrodes a sense of community, so that I can encourage other people to help play a role in righting these wrongs. We can't bring back the dead, but what we can do is to push lawmakers and our fellow citizens to adopt policies that will stop it from happening to other people. And I think that's an important part. Now, I understand how difficult it is to sit with the violence, but I think that if we really believe in justice, then we have to give survivors that time and space.
You've also said that one reaction to the Charleston syllabus and you know, your effort to give us the history of that violence in real time then was that people kept saying, why didn't we know this stuff? But of course, historians did know this stuff. And I gather that that reaction has shaped how you think about your work now.
It has. A lot of people, you know, the statement that we heard was, I didn't know about this. Why aren't they teaching this in school? And it's something that's being taught in some college and university classes, but not universally. And so what that made clear to me, and I think to some of my fellow historians, was that just because we were researching and writing, that didn't mean the larger public had access to what we were doing, what we were discovering in the historical records and the stories we were telling. And not everyone has the privilege of going to college or university and taking our classes. And so we had missed something. We had missed an opportunity to make sure that the larger public understood the histories that we had discovered. There was this sort of belief that, well, I wrote a book, so of course it's out there. It's available. Everybody knows it, right? But that's not how this works. And I think for me, and I think for a number of other people, the Charleston syllabus and the reaction to it, the thirst for more information, made clear that we weren't hitting the audience in a way that we thought we were.
All right. Well, so to that degree, your work is much more public, I gather. And so you've got a new podcast coming called Seizing Freedom. It's about the Reconstruction era, which is a period we talk about kind of constantly on this show. It sounds like a bit of a pivot from the pain you've studied this far, I guess, in the sense that it's, you know, it's described as stories of Black people seizing freedom. So what does the Reconstruction era tell us about the relationship between these two things that you study, between seeing the pain and seizing the freedom?
So one of the things that we know is that African Americans seized freedom during the Civil War, changing the course of the war, and they made the most of freedom. and they help expand our democracy and expand its protections to more Americans. And what we know is that that work wasn't without a cost, because they faced resistance at every step of the way. Freedom wasn't something that could be seized one time and was done. The sort of larger forces of white supremacy were fighting it all along. And so our story, or the story we tell on the podcast, is an uplifting one, but it's a realistic one, because we make sure that the audience knows that the resistance is swift. The resistance is strong and it's violent.
Swift, strong, and violent.
Yes. And so, you know, what we do is we balance that story. So it is an uplifting story, but it's also a very realistic one. So you will see moments, or listeners will encounter moments, where they encounter that violence very closely, very clearly, because Reconstruction is one of the most violent periods in American history, especially for African Americans, because they pay a price with their lives for trying to be free and safe in this country.
And it just feels so... I don't want to overstate the case, but it just feels so relevant right now in terms of which direction are we going to go in the Reconstruction story.
It is, absolutely. And that's why I'm really grateful you didn't ask me, you know, the question that you asked the previous guest about, you know, sort of like how you're feeling.
We're coming to it. I hate to tell you, but go ahead.
Okay. Because on the one hand, I feel lighter, but on the other hand, I know the weight of history. Mm. You know, we've been down this path before. And I don't believe that we're in the clear, even with the moderate in the White House. I just don't. Especially as a Black person and as a historian of racist violence, looking at the state of the world, I'm concerned. And I don't believe that I or we can be naive about the danger that white supremacy poses.
Well, listeners, coming up, we're going to take your calls about what you have been carrying through the Trump era that you're ready to put down, and what you plan to keep close in the way that Professor Williams is talking about now. But I am going to ask you, Professor Williams, if you want to answer either of those questions, if there is something you've been carrying through this era that you feel like I can put that down now.
I mean, I think that one of the things I can put down is the sort of the constant state of anxiety, the not knowing which way the world is going to be spinning when I wake up every morning. I feel like I have slept a little bit better, you know, since the election, and especially since the inauguration, just a little bit better. But what I also hope is that the protests from the past summer will guide Americans. You know, I really hope that Americans have really woken up to the realities of the harms of white supremacy and the violence against Black and brown people, and that they really do mean to make a more just world and society, and that they're willing to sort of put everything on the table to try to make that happen. As a historian, I'm concerned, but there is the part of me when I sort of put that aside, that is hopeful.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to hold both things.
Yes.
Kidada Williams is a professor of African American history at Wayne State University. She's the author of the book, They Left Great Marks on Me, African American Testimonies of Racial Violence from Emancipation to World War I. Her new podcast, Seizing Freedom, launches in February. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey there, a program note. If this particular edition of the show is really speaking to you, I urge you to check out an episode we made in the summer of 2020, right before George Floyd was killed. It's a conversation I had with writer Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya about his short story collection, Friday Black. Among other things, we talk about how we both grapple with the aftermath of anti-Black violence. You can find a link to it in the notes for this episode in your podcast app or on our website, wherever you're listening. And you should always check those notes, because we have started recommending companion listening from our archives for each episode. So I hope you take a look at this one, and happy listening. Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety. And for the rest of the show, the phones are open. We are entering a new chapter for this show, literally, since we began as a response to the Trump campaign and presidency, and obviously for the country. The question I'm asking of myself and of you is this. What have you been carrying through the Trump era that you are ready to put down? And what do you plan to hold on to? And as we take your calls, I'm joined by friend and co-creator of this show, Arun Venugopal. He's now the senior reporter in WNYC's Race and Justice Unit. Hey, Arun.
Hey, Kai.
So, like I said, Arun was the lead reporter on the show back in 2016, and you'll be hearing from him more this year, as he has graciously agreed to host the show whenever I need to step out. And Arun, let me put the questions to you. Let's start with the first one. What have you been carrying through the Trump era that you think you're ready to put down?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's really kind of forced me to think about these last few years. And I guess what I would say, just professionally speaking, all right, as someone who does cover race, but is also just, you know, an all around nice guy and mild mannered individual, what I aspire to do, I'll put it this way, is to abandon all the tiptoeing, the tentativeness, you know, all the euphemisms that we tend to use, the whataboutism, all that stuff that we do in this business, in the business of American news, even as we lurch through this entirely new era of, you know, mobs and insurrections. I'm not sure if this makes any sense, but I'm just kind of done with this sort of the tentativeness that we tend to deploy. And there's a certain kind of dogma in news and an inflexibility, you know, this cautiousness. At a time, you know, when we in this business really cannot afford to be like that, you know, our craft, it just has to better reflect and I think really resemble these times in which we live, you know, and it has to, I think, better recognize and internalize the scale, this enormous problem that kind of looms before us.
Well, let's get right to the phones because folks want to talk. Daniel in Bay Ridge, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kai. Thank you, Arun. My name is Daniel from Bay Ridge, and I've been holding on for a lot longer than the Trump years. Just anger over the fact that as a people, we're having to say that human beings are should be treated with equality and have equity in the world. And I'm trying not to hold every person that I see with a MAGA hat responsible for it. I'm just trying to listen and not hold on to that anger. The thing that I am holding on to, though, is an acute sense of responsibility to have my representative, even though it's Nicole Malliotakis, and to have my representatives in the Senate and to contact every state representative possible to try and hold the Biden administration, President Biden's administration, responsible for their promises of racial justice and racial equity. You have to remember that this is a man who's done an incredible amount of violence to people of color. I say I'm Latino to my community through his through his crime bill, and I would love to see him not only have the opportunity but seize the opportunity to walk that back. And I want to hold on to the idea that it's my responsibility to hold him accountable through my representatives. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Thank you, Daniel. And let's go to Tony in Queens. Tony, welcome to the show.
Hi, welcome. Thank you for taking my call. This is actually kind of negative, to be honest. What I carried through the Trump era was this idea of justice, the idea that in the face of injustice, in the face of wrong, the most we can ask for is justice. Even as victims, we ask for justice. That's the best we can get, and that's what we deserve. After seeing the insurrection, absolutely not. No. I'm at a position now where I can say, honestly, I believe that minorities and African Americans especially deserve more than justice. They deserve some retribution. They deserve to have the other side feel shame, feel embarrassment, to be subject to harms that are outside the scope of our understanding of justice. They should lose property. They should lose jobs. They should lose social standing. What I've seen today, what I saw during the insurrection really cemented in my mind that it is not fair to ask the victims of injustice to be the civilized ones, to be the ones that forgive, to be the ones that turn the other cheek. It is not fair because the other side will take advantage of it, and they have. They got more out of their injustice than we can get back from our justice, no matter how long it is. And the big thing for me is that there used to be a past where I would hold myself down. I would say, look, we can only ask for justice, the most that we can ask for. I say no now. We deserve more than this. We deserve retribution. I wouldn't say violent retribution, absolutely not. But there has to be a sense of shame. There has to be some sense of harm outside of just the scopes of justice.
Thank you, Tony. I'm going to let you go so we can keep going. Christian from Richmond Hill. Christian, welcome to the show.
Hey, Kai. Good to be on. I was saying, you know, as soon as Trump came down those stairs and, you know, I'm Mexican, I'm an immigrant. So as soon as he came down and called us, you know, rapists and murderers, my shield that I tried so hard to put down came up. And then it continued with, you know, the children in cages and with the shootings in El Paso. You know, I've been on high alert. I felt like I've been being personally attacked, you know, for 4 years now. So putting my shield down, my sword down, I can breathe a little bit. But also knowing that I have to be hypervigilant. You know, within my Latinx community, there is anti-Semitism, there is racism. So it's important for me to you know, call that out, to do whatever I can, you know, because my liberation is bound with everybody else's. So that's, you know, I have hope, but I got to keep vigilant.
Thank you, Christian. So Arun, you know, those are some striking calls. The idea of moving past justice that Tony mentioned. I wonder about that and how much you hear that as a reporter among in communities of color, I guess, and what you think of that, this idea that it's time to let go of justice. We need more than justice.
You know, I think that's something you might hear in certain kind of like private circles, the anger that people feel. I think that the way Tony's expressed it here, you know, in public is something that's still relatively rare. I think that there is a real asymmetry. We know that when it comes to, say, policing, the way in which the mob was policed versus how Black Lives Matter was policed, I think is also an incredible asymmetry when we talk about what should the consequences be, you know, and that's something that I think we don't have the language for. And people like Tony, I suppose, are trying to craft a whole language of what happens to people who want to bring down your entire society. You know, I mean, it's a very serious act. We actually haven't thought through that very well because it's all so new, I think. But I think what Christian said, I remember about 4 years ago walking down the street, and when he talked about just putting up your shield, I remember thinking as I was approaching somebody, I was thinking like, does that guy want to punch me in the face? You know, what if he does? You know, it's a whole new feeling. I had never had that feeling, that too. I live in Queens. And yet I kind of thought like, my mailman, does he wish violence upon me? What if he feels like enabled in some way? You have so many thoughts. You project a lot. And I think that that's incredibly, you know, tense. Obviously, it's a very tense and traumatizing way to walk through the world. And I think for some people, it's nice, as you said, so many of us are saying, to exhale a bit, to maybe think that hopefully, you know, you can let your guard down. Although I'm sure that's not the case for a lot of people.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what Tony is saying. Let's take a couple more. Let's go to Richard in Brooklyn. Richard, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks very much. So throughout the last 4 years, we have two young children, our family, well, sort of 12 and 6, now 7. And we are sick of the negative conversation around the dinner table about politics. We're very, you know, engaged family politically. And it just was like, we're talking about a supervillain all the time. And we're just desperately wanting to be able to talk about issues and not just this bad force in the White House. And, you know, we watched the inauguration, and you know, everyone was sort of homeschooling in various parts of the house, and then we kind of dipping in, and there was a lot of excitement. But that our 7-year-old, you know, was ecstatic as the helicopter left the White House, and it was like a TV show, and there's just so much negativity around the dinner table, just sort of, you know, vilifying this, you know, former president, and we're just really excited to get to talking about, you know, issues, like real issues, and a lot of which are negative, but the baseline thus far has just been about negativity of a, you know, personality. And, yeah.
It's so funny to hear you say, you know, and I know I have plenty of friends with young children who have this, but a 7-year-old, you know, that is connected with the idea of this president has left office is really striking about how deeply this got into our families and our lives. I have a follow-up question for you. So then if you're going to let go of that, you're happy to like get negative politics out of your dinner table life. What are you going to pick up?
Well, first of all, it's really hard to let go of that negativity. It's amusing and interesting, like the latest Netflix show, to talk about, you know, the baddie. So we're just trying to, you know, steer the conversation around to, you know, rejoining the Paris Accord and just issues that can be achieved right now, and talking about, you know, what people's agendas are now that are in power and how much good that can potentially bring. And again, it's, you know, there are so many, you know, there's a lot of, you know, dark things happening and things that need to be fixed that are weighty, but at least we can start from a place of hope, as opposed to just constantly, you know, talking about Trump.
It's funny. Yeah, thank you, Richard, for that, because I think it's so true. And it's not just people in this country. I have friends who live in other parts of the world who say this is all we talk about, you know, 2017, 2018, it just on and on. I would almost set sort of boundaries, you know, in the morning if my wife was like, did you hear what? I'd be like, no, just put my hand up. I'm like, not before my tea, you know, not until 7:45. I'm like negotiating here, and not after 10:45 at night. You know, I'm like, we need to kind of like carve out zones of sort of like exemptions from that thing that, you know, I think had all of us sort of like permanently seized. And I think it's kind of like nice to kind of think like, what does that mean? What do you hand over that time to now?
Let's go to Denisa in Washington Heights. Denisa, welcome to the show.
Hi, Kai. How are you?
Very good.
So, putting down is that sort of dread I felt when I first saw Trump, you know, become, the, you know, announce himself as a nominee. And I was like, this is not good. And it was the sort of dread that sort of encompassed a lot of this presidency, and not knowing and uncertainty of like what's going on in Washington, because it just seemed like this circus. And I'm politically active, so it was really hard as someone who enjoys politics to sort of witness this sort of degradation of democracy. And I always kind of knew this sort of path was on its way, but to really see it play out with the presidency was really striking. And why carried with me throughout that whole time was this hope, because I work as a public servant. So I know there are people, you know, in Washington that were, you know, despite working in this under administration, were trying, still doing their work, even under, you know, cut budgets or anything like that, that hope was still there. And, you know, and then once the inauguration day came and I saw, particularly Kamala Harris, Madam Vice President Kamala Harris walk up the steps, I felt really emotional for like the first time after a long time. And I'm like, okay, we're finally in the next chapter of this, you know, American history, and see where we can take it from here.
Thank you for that, Denisa. We also have a tweet that I think pretty well encapsulates how a lot of people are probably feeling. It's how I'm thinking about it. It says, I'm looking forward to putting down the urgent anxiety that the world will go down in flames if I do not act right now while holding on to the practice of being an active participant and pushing for a better tomorrow. So there you go. Yeah. Let's go to Nikki in Harlem. Nikki, welcome to the show.
Hey, Kai. Thanks for taking my call. that tweet definitely encapsulates what a lot of people are thinking. What I could let go of is that long, long breath I was holding on to throughout the entire Trump presidency, because I thought this man was unstable, and he actually wanted a TV channel instead of the presidency. But what I'm holding on to is accountability. One thing I've noticed from older generations is that they talk about us millennials and Gen Zers saying that we're so sensitive about the things that people say or post or on social media. We're not being sensitive. We're actually holding people accountable for the things that they say. This man, I'm going to call him 45 as a code name because I don't like saying his name. 45, he used a series of lies to create an entire movement to stir up the feelings that have been in American white men for over 244 years, and created a movement out of that hatred, out of that imperialistic, grotesque nature that is the American white man, white Christian man. And so I'm holding on to that history, and I'm making sure that generations under me are reminded of this moment in time, because it's not okay to just forget it.
Thank you so much for that. Arun, we got a couple minutes left. First off, briefly, the point Nikki made about the changing conversation and accountability in the conversation, that is something that it feels like is dramatically different in the course of the last 4 years in terms of, what do you think about that?
No, absolutely. And he said that he's Gen Z. I mean, my daughter is too. And I think that there is a level of, I don't know, anger or just simply the unacceptability of it all. That I see and I hear from people who are younger in a way that I think is striking and just refreshing. And it's nice to have people who are entering into the political discourse and who are not willing to tolerate certain norms that, say, some of us may not necessarily be happy about, but somehow reconcile ourselves to. So I thought Nikki expressed it really well.
Yeah. Maybe it's that. What you haven't answered yet, what you're going to carry, that you picked up on, that you're going to carry into the Biden era as another person with power now starts to shape our lives.
Oh, you know, I was listening to you talk earlier to Jericho Brown. It was just like so, just so beautiful what he had to say. And it reminded me of just how much has become banal, you know, cheapened, desensitizing in the last, you know, few years. And people, they say certain kinds of stock phrases. Why are you surprised? You know, I'm surprised, but I'm not shocked. And I don't want to become so glib. And so for me, you know, I have lost a lot of faith in humanity. But one thing that I guess keeps me rooting is, and I guess retains a certain kind of sense of mystery, is art. You know, it's our ability to turn a phrase or create a melody or just a story that swirls within us and, you know, and transforms us.
Arun Vinogopal is the senior reporter in WNYC's Race and Justice Unit. He was the lead reporter for the launch of our very show back in 2016. Good talking to you, Arun.
Thanks, Kai.
And thanks to everybody who called in. Apologies to those we couldn't get to. You can always email me at anxiety@wnyc.org. A special thanks to Howard, who emailed me a poem this weekend after he heard the promo. I'll look forward to tweeting it out. I'm Kai Wright. Thanks for spending this time with us. United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Jared Paul mixed the podcast version. Kevin Bristow and Matthew Miranda were at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Emily Boteen, Jenny Casas, Marianne McCune, Christopher Wirth, and Vera Lynn Williams. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Karen Frillman is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright, and you can always join us for the live version of the show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening and take care of yourselves.